for those who don't know, the thousand true fans are the ones that they spend a larger amount on the products. They line up at the Apple store. They go to every concert for those musicians.
They wear the t-shirt, they, yeah, you know, they have the hats.
Exactly.
Maybe the tattoo.
That's it. Unlock Protocol tattoo. And,
Okay, first of all, this has been a long time coming, so thank you so much for chatting to us.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, okay, so you are based in New York, possibly maybe originally from France. How did that come about?
I sold my previous company that I created, and I lived in France at the time. And the person who acquired it is Medium, and they asked me to move to the U.S., and I said yes. So I moved to New York. I had two kids at the time. Now I have three. And when I left Medium, I didn't want to move again because this is actually not easy. And so I stayed here.
Yeah, right. That's amazing. So I noticed that company that you mentioned, you were doing something in regards to RSS feeds for podcasts and stuff like that, right?
For RSS feeds in general. And podcast is one of the main use cases of RSS these days,
right?
Even though it wasn't the only one. Yes.
Okay, cool. And then prior to that, I think you'd done something else. And that looked really interesting. I wrote it down here. So you did a job board, right? And maybe something that you started during school. It was a bit of a side project. And then somehow it kind of became kind of the leader in its class for students in France. You're getting people like McDonald's, IKEA who are using it. Could you maybe reflect just slightly on that experience?
Yeah, of course. So I'm probably a bit older than you guys, and hopefully not that much people listening to this, but maybe. And it was kind of the late 90s, early 2000. Everybody was like, oh, the internet is magic. Everything is there. And I was looking for a summer job, and I was, I think 19 or 20. I couldn't find anything. And I was like, this sucks. Let me look for something online, because everybody says, you know, the web has this. And there was nothing. And I was like, you know what? I'll create something. And I created, I mean, don't say boredom, but it was never, I mean, at the time it was not intended to be a real thing. Created the job board. The funny thing is I called it job étudiant, which literally means job student in French. So it's like, you know, very, 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 very advanced marketing here. And I didn't want to buy the .com because it felt too commercial. So I bought the .net. And pretty quickly, like, again, I don't remember the exact time because it was 22 years ago. But I got McDonald's to put job offers on the website. And to me, that's when it clicked. That's when I realized the internet is magic. This like random teenager, a bit older than a teenager, I still lived at my parents, create this website. Again, I don't say boredom, but you know, not with real intention. And all of a sudden this is useful. People start to look for jobs on there, post job offers. And for me, that's kind of the realization that this permissionless decentralized platform that the internet is kind of magic.
It's being really early to a category is something that's like so profound, because a lot of people don't realize that you can even make something terrible, and if it's the first job board in France, then it's the first one, and you're instantly the leader. So it's really cool.
Yeah. So it was terrible, to be clear.
Yeah, not that it was terrible.
No implications.
No, but more importantly than this, is like I built it for me. I built it because I was a student and I was looking for something. And so I built something that kind of, you know, scratch your own itch, as they say in the US. So it really worked out pretty well in that scenario, because I was not a very unique student. And so I was like, you know, I'm going to create something that works for me. Hopefully it's going to work for the vast majority of students as well. And it did. And so that's how it ended up being a thing.
Yeah, that's cool. So with Unlock Protocol, what's the main difference between a platform and a protocol?
Yeah, it's almost a philosophical one in many ways. A protocol is something that, you know, in the crypto space, they call public goods, but it's something that is kind of a shared thing that everybody can use, that is permissionless, decentralized, doesn't require, you know, terms of use, doesn't require kind of creating accounts in some ways. Like HTTP that you might know of is a protocol. When you type HTTP/, you know, that's that you basically tell the computer, use this thing to access the content on the other side of the internet. And that's how it works. So a protocol is really a collective agreement on how something should work. And so what Unlock is basically a protocol for memberships. It's a collective agreement of how memberships should work on the internet and beyond, actually. And so that's what it is. on the other end, a platform is usually something that is very much top down. It's like, oh, I create something, people use this. They rely on the platform, and it really is, I mean, you know, platform, I think, I don't know if it comes from French, but if you think it's like something that people sit on, and if you remove it, people fall. And it's kind of the thing is like you end up being sharecropping on the platform's territory, and the platform gets to choose, you know, what to do, what you can do, how you can monetize, what kind of content you publish, et cetera, et cetera. And if you go back to the Web 1 era, like almost 30 years ago, it was all about protocols. It was all about how can we build these systems in a way that anybody can play, and there is no such thing as a central gatekeeper that decides what kind of content you can publish, what kind of web page need to exist, et cetera, et cetera.
Gotcha. Okay. So following on from that, HTTP was a good example. So would it be accurate? You're the computer science here, not me. So you can clarify this. but would it be accurate to say that really that protocol underpins a lot of what we see on the web currently? Would that be an accurate statement?
All of it.
Okay, like, everything. Okay, great.
Pretty much, yeah.
Do you think that whoever the creators of this protocol are, which maybe you would know, or maybe not.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Do you think they were able to like accurately capture the value that really they contributed to the world?
Zero. That's actually one of the issues with these things. Is like, and it's, if you think about protocols, they are also, I'd say, in the same thing as like open source software. It's like almost, God's work. I don't say God's work, but like somebody works for free, creates something, put it out there, and then people
it's like
use
a public
it.
Service.
A public service. And I'm sure Tim Berners-Lee is not poor and, you know, is not starving in the streets, but he's definitely not capturing, you know, any or a lot of the value that he created with the internet in many ways. I don't think it's necessarily a problem. I mean, I think it's a problem when we start to have places that are unsustainable. I would say HTTP and the web is some of the protocols are sustained through what is called the W3C, so World Wide Web Consortium. It's basically a bunch of organizations that go together in Boston, not too far from here, and kind of actually spend a bunch of money every year to send smart people and say, okay, this is how we could evolve, or this is how we should make the web work. And these organizations obviously have a vested interest. So, you know, Google, Microsoft, Apple, to do these things because they rely on the internet being a thing. But first, they don't represent everyone. I am a small website owner. I don't have the money to go, or even the power to go to the W3C and say, hey, this should work this way. So I think this is not very democratic in the end. And it also really, really works for, you know, HTTP. But there's a ton of other things that are not maintained if it wasn't for the, you know, the time and the effort of some independent creators or computer scientists.
I had no idea that's how it works. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks for explaining that.
Going back to Unlock for a second. So one of the main ideas is developing 1,000 true fans. And that's something that you guys really focus on. So for those who don't know, the 1,000 true fans are the ones that they spend a larger amount on the products. They line up at the Apple store. They go to every concert for those musicians.
They wear the t-shirt, the hats.
Exactly. So
maybe the tattoo.
Tattoo.
Unlock protocol tattoo. So one thing that I wanted to ask is, what specifically does Unlock do to focus on those 1,000 true fans, as opposed to, say, the first 100,000 fans? Like, what's specifically different between them and the 100,000?
You know, I don't think we focus specifically on the 1,000 versus the 100,000. It actually stems back from an article that was written in Wired, you know, the magazine. I don't know if you heard of that magazine in the mid 2000s by somebody who was called Kevin Kelly, and he posited the fact that any creator online could now make a living because they can have 1,000 true fans that each pay, I think, $10, and that makes $10,000 a month, and that's plenty to live for a creator around the world. And the thing that he was making is like the internet actually enabled this. Like if you were living in a small village in the, you know, and you're a musician in the 80s, it's unlikely that you'll have 1,000 big fans in your small village. And so you would have to go to the big city to actually gather enough of an audience to start to make a difference. But the internet makes it possible for you to gather that 1,000 true fans because they might live, you know, in Australia, you're in the US, or they might live in Russia and you're in the US, and they become fans enough that they want to support you. And again, $10 a month is both a lot of money and also not that much if you, in the grand scheme of things. Really, the idea of Unlock behind this is to say, rather than use attention to monetize everything online, which is what we've done by default, like using ads, we should think about alternative business model. And the membership business model is one that I think is critical. It's the idea that every creator, every organization, every company has a set of fans, whether it's 1,000, you know, maybe 100 to get started, 1,000, or even 100,000. And these fans, that community of people are the one that in practice should be supporting or becoming members of the organization. And that's true, again, for indie creators that have 1,000 true fans on their music platform and allows them, music website, should I say, all the way to kind of, you know, large publication. You can think of The Guardian or New York Times or whatever large publication having a set of readers that are supporting it through their subscriptions.
Gotcha. And then in steps in Unlock Protocol, I suppose that this is really the thesis or the proposition that sparked your thought, okay, maybe, sure, it's possible for this to happen, but let me create something that actually makes it really simple. Is that right?
Exactly right. Okay. Simple, and even beyond that simple, is you make it standard. Making it work the same way across the board. Because in the same way that HTTP, you know, you can use the same web browser, whether it's Chrome or Safari, to use all of the websites, we wanted to create something that allows every creator to say, I'm going to deploy my membership contract. I'm going to sell memberships in the form of NFTs. We'll come back to this. And then it's going to work the same, whether it's on, you know, Clubhouse or whether it's on a random small site or whether it's on Twitter or whether it's on Facebook or whether it's on Patreon. It should be the same membership primitive that every single creator is using. They set the price, they set a bunch of terms that are specific to them, but then it's kind of, it kind of behaves the same.
That's sick. That's a really good, you know, it's a really good way to focus on those communities, you know. One of those features that I saw, which is really cool, that Unlock does is airdropping, right? So I think that's a really good way to keep those communities kind of engaged really well. So one of the biggest ones that I saw in the last couple of years, at least, was Ethereum Name Service. So where they paid thousands of dollars worth of ENS to ENS holders of Ethereum, and then all of a sudden they were rewarded for holding all of these domains, and they didn't even, it's not even like they held the name, like an early domain, and sold it to someone. They just held it, and all of a sudden they got paid. In that example, it was a huge surprise when they were dropped it. Is it better for creators to surprise their fans and everyone to, you know, kind of hear about it later and join in on this platform? Or would you prefer to build in, let's say, like some kind of cash flow model into your products?
Both. I think each creator is different, right? Some creators might sell their membership, say, okay, cool, you're going to pay me $2 a month and you can be able to access the content. It works great for podcasting, for example. Some other creators might say, you know what, the membership is free, but you have to do something to earn it. At that point, I will airdrop it to you. So you don't pay for your subscription. You do something like hold a domain name for long enough, or, you know, join a Discord or follow someone on Twitter, whatever that is. And then in return for that thing that you've done, you are being airdropped a membership card, an NFT that actually shows that you're one of these.
Gotcha. Okay. So could we take a practical approach to this now? So let's say, for example, I'm the user.
Yep.
And I'm not necessarily the platform or the project. I'm the user who's trying to come and have the experience. So up until now, as you originally mentioned with that article, it was possible to have this membership model, be it in a form of, you know, maybe a few layers of a tech stack where you could go in, you could make a login, you could maybe add your card details and bits and pieces like that. And then as you were kind of mentioning there, the issue comes about where it's like, well, what if the project has a Discord and a YouTube channel and all of these different things? Am I going to have to make 3 or 4 different accounts? And it becomes this big nuisance to the user. And then they might be part of four or five different projects that they find interesting. So then you come in and you go, well, let me just create this token that is interoperable across all these different platforms. And so that makes a lot of sense to me. Is there, it's a dichotomy though, because then most of the world is used to doing the login stuff. And yep. So how do you think about trying to, we know it's simpler, but how do we try and encourage the common person who it seems like a big barrier? Do you know what I mean? It's not, yeah. It's in their head, but how do we encourage them to jump in and be a part of it?
I mean, I think you said it. It's not in their head. It's just a matter of finding use cases that are simple enough that they have to go through and then realize, like, you know what, actually it wasn't difficult. One of the things that we focus on at Unlock over the last year is tickets to conferences. People want to buy tickets to attend an event. And it's actually not, okay, cool, I'm going to get a wallet. And we provide a bunch of tooling to make it easy. I'm going to buy a ticket. Oh, it's a QR code. Oh, it happens to be also an NFT. And now I realize that, you know what, this thing that I thought was going to be complicated is actually pretty straightforward. And so we really think that the way to get there is to move away from the, oh, you're going to invest money, get rich kind of schemes, because that's actually not attracting many people. I mean, it attracted all the people that it was supposed to attract, I think, at this point. And moving to something much simpler, much easier. It's like, hey, you want to access this, you're going to just have to download this little wallet and then click these two buttons, and then you get a ticket to attend the thing, or you get access to this website. It's actually much easier and simpler. I'm going to go back again 20, 25 years. You guys probably were seven, maybe not even that. Early internet, when I connected the first time to the internet, my mom at the time had to go buy a modem, a specific device that was plugged into the computer and then plugged into the telephone line, which, if you think about this, doesn't make much sense. Like, first, people don't know what a telephone line is anymore, but it was before mobile phones. And so basically plug in the telephone line. And then you had like this crazy noise. It was like making, and then you'd be connected. That, again, we're recording a podcast. I don't know where you guys are, but like, we're probably in different continents or different countries at least. And it's working without us thinking about this. But if you go back 25 years ago, the internet was really frictionful. People had no idea how to make things work. It was messy. And now it's all obvious for everyone. I think it's going to be pretty much the same for crypto. It's going to be much faster than that, because people are already used to paying online and using accounts or something that looks like a wallet on the website. So I think it's going to be pretty straightforward. We just have to move away from the, oh, this use case is you staking token to earn some yield, which feels like what? Like, it's not normal. It is very normal to pay to access something. And so we should just move into these kind of models, which are healthier, doesn't feel as dirty, I guess, as all of these kind of some of the schemes that exist out there at this point.
It's pretty crazy that we've gone from dial up to NFTs in such a short period of time. Like, it's such a huge leap between one concept and another. One thing that you were talking about there was, say, QR codes when you're in a conference and, oh, it just happens to be an NFT. Something that's really cool on Unlock that I saw on Unlock's website is that there are integrations with Shopify, WordPress, Discord. So how I would imagine that it kind of works with Shopify is, say, if you had a POAP, a proof of attendance protocol for attending your favorite artist's concert, for example. So you might be able to buy some unique merch from that tour
on their store,
on their Shopify store, exactly. Or you could join an exclusive level of their community on Discord, or you could kind of get some special access to some creator's blog, for example. Is that right? Is that kind of what the use is?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I think I'd go beyond this, because it allows for kind of cross-network membership. So you mentioned the artist, you go to the concert, and then you go on their Shopify store and you get a discount. Actually, something even better. You go on some brand's Shopify store, and they give you a discount because you're a fan of that artist, and the artist represents the brands pretty well. So it's not about, you know, just inside of the same circle. It's like, now, you know, my Air France membership, because I'm flying with Air France a lot, gives me a discount at a French restaurant here in the city, because I don't know, they have some kind of deal. And so really it doesn't have to be inside of the same creator, but it can be beyond that, a way to create partnerships.
Gotcha. Okay. That's cool. That's really, really cool. Okay. So for a business, so you've got a token, which is called UDT, right?
Yes.
And this is like the way that you govern the protocol and how it's going to be used in the future and stuff like that. And my understanding is that basically, in simple form, people who use the protocol, who are using it in their projects, the use of it generates some of that token for themselves. And the benefit of that is, as you kind of alluded to very early on in this conversation, where you don't have any say in that meeting regarding, you know, Web3 or WW, whatever you said it was.
WPC, yes.
Where all the people who control the internet come and have a conversation. You can't go in and have that conversation because you've got no stake in it, right? You're a small fish in a very, 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 very big ocean. But these people, dependent on how, I guess, active they are, can have a say in what's happening on the platform. Could you talk a bit about that, maybe the future of where you'd like to see that go?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with something like a warning, I guess. If you use a protocol, you don't need to know about UDT. You don't need to care about this if you don't want to care. It's just that it's optionally, if you want to say, hey, this protocol is interesting and I want a stake in it, I want a say in how it works because I'm using it. And if I'm using it, I should have a say in how it works. I don't want this to be kind of changed without my consent in that way. Then it's possible. It is possible because we have a governance token and it's minted, it's created and distributed, exactly what you described. Every time somebody uses the protocol, there is new tokens that are being distributed to the people that are using the protocol. At that point, these governance tokens are ways to vote on, you know, future upgrades, what to do with the treasury and things like this. And so it really is a core Web3 concept that when you use something, it's not just you're using it and you're just again, sharecropping on somebody else's property. You become, or you have the option if you want to become, I don't want to say a owner because it's kind of weird to say an owner of a protocol, but you become a stakeholder. Your voice can be heard. Now you have a mechanism to say, hey, I think this should do X or this should do Y or we shouldn't do this. And that voice is obviously proportional to the amount of use that you make. So if millions of people are using your application and you rely on the protocol to make a business, then you should have a say in that. It's almost like, you know, one of these YouTubers, they should have a say in how the YouTube algorithm works. Like if that's how they make money and how their business works, collectively at least, all of the YouTubers should be able to say, okay, we want the YouTube algorithm to work this way or to work that way. That is not how it works in Web2, yeah. But that's how it will work in Web3.
Yeah, wow. That's something that I hadn't really thought of the use for the DAO fully. So that brings a lot of clarity to that because I was kind of like, oh, why does everything need a DAO, you know? But being a protocol, it actually makes a lot of sense. One of the DAOs on Unlock's website there is Bakery DAO, which is one of the tools which kind of lets you lock content across multiple websites, which is a really cool kind of concept there.
It's actually one of the creators that use. So you are. It's one community. I think it's called Bakery DAO, but their website called pastry.xyz, and they put some content out there. And they're one. You know, they're one example of a membership that you can get that is using Unlock. Amazon Prime is another one that you'll eventually be able to use, or you know, supporting. Any kind of podcast could be one of the other members.
Yeah, right. Okay, cool. So that's just something that that uses the Unlock protocol then. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, so one thing that I thought was really cool and it really reminded me of the whole concept of being like non-custodial. So we talked to someone who has a savings app basically a couple of weeks ago and he was kind of really into the concept of yeah, you can just pick this up though and take it completely away from our platform if you want to and drop it into another platform. And because it's non-custodial, you actually own it. We as a platform don't own it, which I thought was a really cool concept. And it means that if they're not doing the cutting edge and they're not being the absolute best platform,
you can just
pick it up and put it down. So is the concept of a non-custodial wallet, for example, very similar to Unlock as a protocol? Like, can you unlock?
No, it works hand in hand. It basically, you would use the non-custodial wallet with you, and then the wallet receives or has the NFT attached to it. So that means that as a user, when you go to another platform and use the same wallet on that other platform, well, your NFTs, your memberships follow you. So you can really kind of, it's kind of a complementary thing if you want.
Gotcha. Following on from that, a lot of platforms, they have kind of like a simple version for the newcomers, be it like, let's say, for example, they're minting, some people will allow you to use, you know, just a normal Visa card to input some fiat and they figure out the back end to make it work to try and help onboard people. Is there that version of this? Like, is there kind of like a custodial version where you kind of hold the hands of the people a little bit? Could you talk about that?
Yeah, we built, so it's not quite the core protocol. The core protocol is the membership thing we described, but we know that obviously not everybody is technical and using the core protocol by writing code is not the most convenient thing for most people. So we built on top of it a convenience layer. So tooling that allow people who either have wallets or even don't have wallets to easily unlock access memberships. And so basically they have an email and password exactly like they would do on Facebook or Google, right? Email and password. And in that case, since they don't necessarily have, they don't know, but they have a crypto wallet and they don't necessarily have it loaded with cryptocurrencies, we allow them to purchase with credit card. So in that scenario, as an end user, you actually don't, you know, you don't see the difference between using something like Patreon and Unlock. The one big difference is like you still have an NFT under the hood, which means that your membership exists everywhere where the blockchain is accessible, which is probably everywhere on the web, beyond just available in that specific platform that you might have bought the membership from.
Yeah, cool. And we've seen on the roadmap so far that that the project's already achieved like the decentralized governance section, which you kind of already touched on there. Some UI achievements, features in the public lock protocol, like some of the non-expiring keys, for example, and gas refunds for users. So that was really cool. And then support for Apple Pay was on the way currently. So that's something that ties into the custodial
exactly.
aspect.
The continuous layer.
Nathan was talking about there. So basically, what's one of those steps on the roadmap that you're most excited about coming up?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that we're thinking a lot about these days, I'm sure your listeners are familiar, but in the Ethereum ecosystem, there is multiple chains, so-called EVM ecosystem. So Ethereum mainnet, Polygon, Gnosis chain, and then there's all of the L2s like Optimism, Arbitrum, you know, all of these. Since we're available on all of these, we want to now allow people to easily, I don't want to say bridge because it's a loaded term right now, but get a membership on a chain by paying on another one. So say I have never configured my wallet for Polygon, but this membership is on Polygon. How can I pay for this on mainnet and then get my NFT on the Polygon network? And so that's one of the things that we're working on right now to actually, again, simplify the experience and make it smoother and easier so that people don't have to think twice about how they use the protocol.
Gotcha. In regards to Unlock being able to capture some value for itself, we talked a little bit about the issues that previous protocols have had in not being able to do that and having to maybe sort of create alternative sources of revenue based on, you know, previous experience. You know, you could write a book, I'm sure you could go
yep,
do
yep, that's,
speaking
yep.
events and stuff. And I'm sure that's all great. But I assume that convenience layer that you're talking about provides some way for you to capture some value. Is that the main source of income so, that you think you can see in the business model?
Yeah. So the protocol itself right now doesn't capture any value. We do actually have in the roadmap the plan to say on every single transaction, the protocol would capture, you know, 1%, okay. 2% on every transaction. So say I unlock the another block membership, it's 10 DAI a month. Well, maybe out of these 10 DAI, you know, 10 cents, whatever, or 20 cents goes to the DAO. And the idea of this going back to the DAO is like this way the DAO can sustain its work and hire people to create the next version of the protocol and things like this. So that's something that we're thinking about buying, building in inside of the core protocol. And that would be the way to do this. Unlock Labs, our core team, has built, as I said, the continuous layer. And we've built, for example, the credit card gateway. When there is, it's not part of the core protocol, but when there is credit card payments, we actually do take a fee on top of the base transaction. So if people were to buy a 10 DAI membership with credit card, they will end up paying probably $11 or maybe $10.50. I don't know what it is. And then 50 cents would go to us and actually be split with, you know, the credit card processors and stuff like this.
Yeah, cool. So with building all of those protocols, for example, I know that, so obviously you started with just yourself after a exit. So basically, what does the team look like now? How's it kind of grown?
Absolutely. Team is 7 people right now, 4 engineers, myself included, all around the world, which is pretty exciting. And then we have somebody who does BD, business development, somebody who does marketing, and a designer. So again, in a developer advocate as well. So it's still a fairly small team, but you know, we're early. It's kind of a pretty obvious phrase in the Web3 space, but I'm actually deeply convinced that we're still very early. And so it's important to grow as, you know, as we grow rather than grow faster than the actual adoption of the technologies.
Gotcha. Okay. As we finish, so we get a lot of people, obviously we love to focus on music and how Web3 technology, crypto, NFTs, how that stuff is influencing the music industry. And so I think there's probably a number of people who watch our podcast who are kind of, they come from the perspective of the music industry and are trying to learn about how this technology can influence their career and what they're doing. What would you say to a musician who's established, has a good following, has a bunch of listens on DSPs, and wants to make the step? Maybe they've got a website, it's just a standard website, they sell a bit of merch on it, whatever. What's their steps and how can they capture all the value that Unlock has to offer for them?
Yeah, I think the first step is thinking about, okay, what is the way for you to identify your 1,000 true fans, going back to that? Like, you're a musician, you're established, you have a bunch of people listening to your music, maybe you put your stuff on Spotify and other platforms. Great. But now you need to start thinking about these again, 1,000 true fans, or maybe it's 100 to get started, or 10,000. I don't know what it is, what stage you're at, but like, start with this. And so identify these people, and then maybe try to get them a badge. Try to see if they can have a unique thing about themselves. And that badge should be an NFT, should be a non-fungible token. Now, once you start thinking about this, you can think, okay, is this for me a way to make money? If it is, then you pretty should think about some kind of recurring subscription that people need to kind of top up every month to keep their membership active. Then think about some benefits. Okay, maybe, you know, every Thursday night you do a jam session on your website, and that jam session is going to be broadcasted only to the people that have the NFT in their wallet. So maybe that one of the benefits. Start to think about, you know, other kinds of musicians that you'd like to partner with, and then maybe reach out to them and say, hey, you guys, I would love to promote your content to my fans. What if on your website you give them access because they have my NFT in your wallet? So that's the way to think of this. But really, for me, the message I'm trying to pass to these creators is, like, think of your membership in the same way that you would think of your website or your, it's not a great idea, but like your Facebook page. It's kind of a way to have a relationship with your fans. It's a way to kind of recognize these people when they're, you know, in the streets or somewhere else at a concert, or to identify themselves as fans, like they have your NFT membership in their wallet.
Gotcha. Can I just make one distinction that you mentioned that I think is really important? Is that there's characteristics such as that timeout feature, right? So I assume that when you're creating this, when you're adding the protocol to your website or whatever you're doing, you can indicate as to how long that timeout feature lasts,
right? And that's your choice, right? As a creator. So you can say, okay, gotcha. The membership is, you know, a day long. Doesn't make a lot of sense. It's a year long. Really doesn't make either. I mean, yeah, it could be. Or a week or a month. And then you say, I'm going to keep people's membership up to date or active if they pay me $5 or $5 USDC a month. And so that's your choice as a creator. You can also have multiple tiers of membership. You can say, okay, I've got my, you know, 1,000 true fans, and then I've got the 10,000 net as true fans, I guess, or the 100,000 passersby. And that's possible. And each have different tiers, different prices, different benefits. Maybe you can even say, okay, cool. If you have the 1,000 true fan thing, you get access to my jamming session, and you're displayed on my screen. If you're just a passerby member, well, you get to listen to this, but you don't actually have any special benefits there.
That's cool. That's very
well,
cool.
This has been a great episode of Another Block Studios. We've had Julian from Unlock Protocol, the second ever Frenchman on the show, and an excellent founder. Very cool protocol. So basically, where can people go to find out more? Where do you want to send our fans to kind of see what you're up to?
Yeah, unlock-protocol.com. So that's the website. You can actually unlock our own membership. It's a free one, but that's a good way to go through the checkout process. Scroll down a bit on the website, you'll find it in the middle. And once you have this, one of the perks is you can access the Discord channel, you can access the Telegram room, you have a bunch of other perks here. So that's the best way. Obviously, you can find us on social networks as well. And if you're a dev or somebody who's thinking about building things in the Web3 space, definitely check out our GitHub. We do have bounties there and places where you can learn about stuff that could be interesting to build for the protocol.
Nice. That's amazing. I noticed that, as Isaac said, you're the second French person that we've had on the podcast. And I've noticed both have potentially been my favorites. Is there something about being French that makes you like an amazing podcast guest?
I'm convinced. Yeah, I'm convinced about this. I don't know who was the first one, but yes, amazing.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's honestly been so fun. It's so cool when we have a guest who's actually like fun and has cool things to say. It's not always the case, so appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm excited, and thanks for taking the time and listening to my rambles.